Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
The UN is to authorize a new peacekeeping force for the CAR. And Pistorius testifies he no intention of killing his girlfriend. I'm Frances Alonzo reporting from Washington. The United Nations Security Council is set to authorize a new expanded peacekeeping force for the Central African Republic. The Security Council on Thursday is expected to adopt a resolution calling for a force of 10,000 soldiers and 1,800 police to help restore order in the country. According to a draft resolution seen by VOA, the UN force will be operational by September 15th when it will take over from the existing African force in the CAR. 6,000 African troops and 2,000 French troops have been unable to contain sectarian violence that has killed thousands of people. South African runner Oscar Pistorius has testified that he did not intend to kill his girlfriend, Reeva Steenkamp, or anyone else the night he shot her last year. In his third day on the witness stand today, the prosecution began a tough cross-examination by pressing Pistorius to say that he takes responsibility for her killing. He broke it down in tears after the lead prosecutor, Jerry Nell, displayed a graphic a picture of Steenkamp's bloodied head.
My lady, I was there that night.
That's it. Have a look there, mister. I know you don't want to because you don't want to take responsibility, but it's time that you look at it. Take responsibility for what you've done, Mr. Pistorius.
My lady, I've taken responsibility by me waiting and not wanting to live my life, but waiting for my time on this stand to tell my story for the respect of Reeva and for myself. I've taken responsibility, but I will not look at a picture where I'm tormented by what I saw and felt that night.
Pistorius began his testimony today recounting the moments after the shooting, saying he felt helpless while waiting for paramedics to arrive at his Pretoria home. You can follow more details and more of Pistorius' comments at voanews.com. Italy says it has rescued 4,000 migrants from the Mediterranean Sea in the past 2 days. The country's interior minister told Italian state radio today that migrant rescues and landings have been nonstop and the migrant emergency is getting worse. He is demanding the European Union do more to help police Mediterranean waters, saying tens of millions of dollars have failed to solve the problem. Italy is the main gateway to Europe for African migrants seeking to escape war, poverty, and political turmoil. Afghanistan's presidential ballot last Saturday has been widely hailed as a triumph for the people. But Sharon Bain reports that with votes still being counted, hopes for a smooth end to the election are beginning to fade as candidates appear to maneuver for a political fight to the finish.
The vote results for a new president of Afghanistan are not in yet, but already the two top rivals among the candidates are each claiming a win. Technocrat Ashraf Ghani, a former World Bank official, told media he is certain he received a majority of the votes, given the turnout in areas where he gathered a lot of support. His chief competitor, former Foreign Minister Abdullah Abdullah, has said he is sure that 60% of the voters had cast their ballots for him. To win the election, a candidate needs 50% plus one vote. If no one reaches that threshold, there will be a runoff. Sharon Bain, VOA News, Islamabad.
A high-level Christian delegation from Lebanon is calling for a nation to stop selling arms to the warring factions in Syria. Lisa Schlein reports.
A high-ranking delegation of Maronite prelates from Lebanon is at the United Nations in Geneva to press its case for peace in the Middle East and, in particular, for Syria. Archbishop Paul Saya, who is vicar general to the Patriarch in Lebanon, says the war in Syria will stop when everybody stops selling arms to those who are fighting. Archbishop Saya says the delegation, which is led by His Beatitude Cardinal Bechara, held a somewhat depressing meeting with UN Envoy for Syria, Lakhdar Brahimi. He says the UN mediator feels disillusioned and sees no way forward in the peace process at the moment. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Search crews in the Indian Ocean have reacquired the underwater signal they believe could belong to the flight data recorder of the missing Malaysian jetliner. The Australian search chief Angus Houston said the transmissions were detected by a U.S. Navy towed pinger locator on two separate occasions on Tuesday. He said more signals need to be detected and the search area better refined before authorities can deploy a robot submarine to search the ocean floor. Authorities, however, are running out of time as the battery on the black box locator for the plane it lasts only 30 days. I'm Frances Alonzo, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to African News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhiben coming up this hour on African News Tonight.
The medical aid group Doctors Without Borders describes conditions at a camp for the displaced in South Sudan as appalling. It accuses the UN mission, UNMISS, of not doing enough to protect thousands of people there. UN officials deny the accusation and say protecting civilians is their top concern.
That's VOA's Jody Capua reporting. Details next.
Also in the news, recent improvements in national security have led to growing optimism that Somalia could finally be taking steps towards lasting stability. And a Cairo court refuses to appoint new judges for the trial of Mohamed Morsi, charged with jailbreak and spying.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the medical aid group Doctors Without Borders describes conditions at a camp for the displaced in South Sudan as appalling. It accuses the UN mission UNMISS of not doing enough to protect thousands of people there. UN officials deny the accusation and say protecting civilians is their top concern. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
About 21,000 people are crowded into the Tomping UN peacekeeping base in Juba. People fled to the base after fighting broke out between government forces and rebels in December. Stefan Lillegrien, MSF project coordinator in Juba, describes conditions in Tomping.
They are cramped up in a very, very tiny area, which is known to be flood-prone. And floods has already happened due to rain. The humanitarian organizations have been pushing for more space. The UN MISS here at Juba are really putting a lot of obstacles for humanitarians working here in this area. One obstacle after the other are being presented to us. Instead of finding solutions for the problems, they are postponing and changing ideas, and they're giving it people land and taking it back again.
He says just getting from shelter to shelter is a problem.
People have their houses in standing water, and to reach to a lot of these houses now, you have to walk through water that are 10, 15, 20 centimeters deep.
MSF warns conditions are ripe for an epidemic of diarrheal, respiratory, and skin diseases. UNMISS has announced plans to close the Tomping camp next month and move people to a base known as UN House or Juba House. It's on higher ground. The MSF project coordinator says it sounds good, but there are problems.
It's not a bad idea to move these people to another location, but the time framing on this is completely out of sync because the new place will not be ready in time to move these people. And meantime, more spaces needs to be allocated within the UN compound so we can prevent potential very bad spread of diseases here.
Lilje Grien says heavy rains will greatly slow or block any move to the UN House location, which already holds 11,000 displaced people. What's more, he says, that humanitarian groups have encountered repeated obstacles or refusals from UNMISS to get more space in Tomping.
Some people are really understanding the situation and are really helping us, but then local commanders or battalion chiefs are blocking, no, you cannot have this space because I need it for my battalion, and some other commanders say, no, I need this one for containers, and another one say, I need this, and nobody's giving.
He rejects UNMISS's assertion that it's doing all it can to help and protect civilians.
They are not doing everything they can, not at all. They could have done a lot more, a lot sooner. We have been asking for this for a long time.
UNMISS spokesperson Ariane Quantier agrees conditions are bad at the Tomping base, saying the situation is of great concern.
It is of great concern for two reasons. One is that this place is not meant and appropriate to have thousands of people living there, but it is congested. And it's always been congested from the first day because people literally flocked into our site, fleeing for safety when the violence erupted. The other concern is, of course, the rainy season. That makes the conditions even worse.
She says UNMISS is well aware of the danger of a possible disease outbreak.
If you take the combination of these two elements, which is the congestion of the camp and the rainy season, you have a situation where these protection sites are turning into death trap, because if there is an outbreak of disease, this will spread throughout the area like wildfire.
Quantier says UNMISS has a two-part strategy to deal with the situation.
One is to try to have people relocating on a voluntary basis to other areas. What I'm calling other areas is either extension of existing sites that we have on our compound or new sites on land made available to us by the government. And this is something we've asked the authorities from the very first day, to have more land to be able to decongest the site.
About 1,500 people of the 21,000 at Tamping have been relocated to other sites so far. Part two of the strategy, she says, is improving conditions at existing sites, including water, sanitation, and basic health services.
We have been saving thousands of lives by the mere fact of opening our gates and having, for the last 3.5 months, over 80,000 people who have stayed on our bases. And I think this is what the people wanted. They voted with their feet. They are still on our side. And I think UNMISS has saved 85,000 lives, plus prevented the country in descending into worse chaos.
Quantier says UNMISS has a duty to protect them. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
For years, Somalia has been referred to as a failed state, synonymous with piracy, poverty, and terrorism. Recent improvements in national security, however, have led to growing optimism that the country could finally be taking steps towards lasting stability. Somali officials say a stronger economy is vital to prolonged peace, and this week they traveled to the United Arab Emirates with the hope of attracting foreign investment to the war-torn nation. Philip Walter Wellman reports from Dubai.
Participants at the Somali Investment Summit in Dubai painted a different picture of the East African country than the one the world has become familiar with.
If in past years the image was hunger, piracy, terrorism, today if you will see a different scenario, you will see a light at the end of the tunnel, you will see hope and that life is coming back. So this is the image we now want to show.
That was Ali Mohamed Gedi, the former prime minister of Somalia's transitional federal government. Growing stability in Somalia, which is grappling with a two-decade-old civil war, can largely be attributed to outside intervention. Over the past year, African Union troops helped drive al-Shabaab militants from major cities, and out at sea, international naval patrols led to a significant decrease in pirate attacks. But Getty warns that the outcome of these efforts could be short-lived unless more is done to address the underlying problem of poverty among the Somali population.
The young generation who have been employed by al-Shabaab, they are not ideologically radicalists, but for their survival. So if we create jobs for them, I believe that they play a role in the stabilization and the security of the country.
Hassan Dude, the chairman of the Somali Economic Forum, agrees that the lure of illegal activity, especially piracy, will always be great when employment opportunities do not exist. He says attracting investment to Somalia now, when the security situation is improving, is crucial, as it will create jobs and help promote safety not only in the country, but throughout the region.
I think what the international organizations and international community is starting to realize is that bringing troops to Somalia will not be the answer to this problem. When people have jobs and you know, better life, of course, they will be less likely to get in trouble.
While conditions in Somalia have been improving, they're by no means ideal for investors. In addition to safety threats and the lack of a central government, corruption is rife and there's an absence of a skilled workforce. There is also no secure legal framework for foreign investors, although authorities are reportedly in the process of forming new legislation.
Investors are a bit afraid of actually going into situations like that, but there's a huge opportunity. The GDP growth of Somalia is equal to Ethiopia. It's actually higher than some of the stable African countries. Somalia is growing. The economy is growing.
That was Hirsi Darir, the CEO of Dahabshil Bank, which operates 130 branches in the country. Analysts say Somalia has substantial potential natural resources, including agriculture, livestock, fishing, and hydrocarbons. Its telecommunications sector is also expected to attract future investors. Although an increase in stability has led to a growing number of investments from overseas, overall activity remains weak. The United Arab Emirates, Oman, and Yemen are the leading investing nations in Somalia. This is Philip Walter Wellman for VOA News, Dubai.
15 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. A Cairo court refused to appoint new judges for the trials of Mohamed Morsi, the nation's ousted former president. Morsi and other Muslim Brotherhood supporters are charged with jailbreak and spying. The trials are part of a government crackdown on the Muslim Brotherhood, which has been outlawed. More than 1,400 have died in the violence and thousands arrested. In another court, 18 Morsi supporters today were sentenced 3 to 7 years in jail on charges of inciting a riot during a July demonstration in Cairo's Soubra district. Public demonstrations must have prior approval by the government.
Morsi could face the death penalty if convicted in his two trials. Lawyers for the defendants requested new judges, but an appeals court turned down the request. Morsi and 130 others are accused of organizing a jailbreak and attacking police stations during the 2011 uprising that toppled ex-president Hosni Mubarak. Many of the defendants are Palestinian and Lebanese militants. Morsi and 35 others are accused of conspiring with the Palestinian Islamist movement Hamas and Shiite Iran to destabilize Egypt. Morsi also faces trial on charges of inciting supporters to attack opposition demonstrators during his year in office.
More than 150,000 Ethiopian migrants have been expelled from Saudi Arabia. The International Organization of Migration, IOM, partnered with the Ethiopian government and civil society groups to engage Ethiopians in alternatives to migration and to look at ways to combat what is now called irregular migration. Forums called Community Conversations will train more than 800 community conversation facilitators in the next 2 months. This will include religious and community leaders and representatives of vulnerable groups, including women and the elderly. Layuna Demsis specializes in irregular migration, human trafficking, and smuggling for IOM in Ethiopia. She spoke with me about their new program by first explaining what is meant by irregular migration.
There's no clear or universally accepted definition of irregular migration. However, in IOM, we understand irregular migration as a movement that takes place outside the regulatory norms of sending, transit and receiving countries. From the perspective of destination countries, it's entry, stay or work in a country without the necessary authorization or documents required and immigration regulations.
Why is it important to have this type of a forum, community conversations?
One of the reasons is like in communities, especially in rural Ethiopia, most community members are not fully aware of the full extent of the risks involved in irregular migration. Our survey conducted end of 2013 indicated that though some of them are aware of the risks involved, irregular migration in terms of their lives, sexual violence and the like, or kidnapping, all this, but they don't, because of their age, their understanding of the world and everything, they don't really understand the full extent of the risks involved.
What would be an example of the type of information a young person who is considering migration, considering to leave, what kind of information would they receive at the forum?
In this forum, it will be comprised of community leaders, parents. For instance, there is a smallest administrative unit in a community, which is Qabale, in Ethiopian context. And there are Qabale managers and also community leaders assigned, religious leaders, women and girls. At the same time, parents will be involved in this community conversations. So when they are involved, they'll have a chance to channel this information to different levels in the society. The main potential migrants are young girls and boys making this decision, but they are financed by their parents. Parents should be informed, and also they can play a critical role in influencing the decisions of their children.
How will you all be training people to provide information to people?
One of the things, like, we have developed a conversation manual. In this manual, what we are trying to do is the first important point is for them to understand the concept behind migration, like what's irregular migration, human trafficking and smuggling and the like. Because in some cases, when people are living without acquiring the necessary documents, they don't really know that they are violating another sovereign country. So it's also important for community members at the grassroots level to understand all these concepts. So establishing this concept is key, one element, for them to understand very well what's irregular migration, human trafficking, smuggling, mixed flows, and the like. So once they understand and fully comprehend these elements, they can also see how they can channel this information to communities at the grassroots level, where we see resonating this information to all levels of the community.
Leonette Demsis specializes in irregular migration, human trafficking, and smuggling for IOM in Ethiopia. She spoke with me from Addis Ababa.
Twenty years after close to 1 million people were slaughtered in the Rwandan genocide, U.S. military officials are confident that forces are better positioned to prevent a repeat of such mass slaughter. But as VOA's Jeff Sladen reports from the Pentagon, Washington is still concerned about security across the African continent.
Fears run rampant across much of the Central African Republic, where 2,000 people have been killed in ethnic violence since December, and some African peacekeepers have already pulled out. But U.S. defense officials say that African forces have been able to intervene is a sign things are slowly improving.
The African forces that now are available that participate in these intervention, those type of things, have expanded incredibly in the last 20 years. I mean, 6 nations in Somalia, 9 going to 16 in Mali.
And the commander of the U.S. Africa Command, General David Rodriguez, says American forces are also better positioned to respond, with as many as 6,000 troops on the ground, including some at a forward operating base in Djibouti and trainers in Uganda, aiding the effort to track and stop warlord Joseph Kony and his Lord's Resistance Army.
They continue to get weaker every day, and we're going to continue to support the efforts of the African Union Regional Task Force to finish this off.
But deep concerns remain about the growing nexus of extremists, especially in northeastern Mali and southwestern Libya. Rodriguez points to the 2013 attack on a gas facility in En Amenas, Algeria, where 3 al-Qaeda-linked groups joined forces.
They're also transferring things that are very worrisome, like the IED technology and tactics, techniques, and procedures.
In addition, U.S. defense officials say they and their African partners worry about the flow of extremist fighters to Syria and their eventual return across sometimes porous borders. But even as U.S. forces draw down from Afghanistan, Deputy Assistant Defense Secretary for African Affairs Amanda Dory says don't expect a heavier U.S. presence in Africa.
Our small footprint and targeted support, working with willing partners, fulfills both our own strategic approach and is the way our African partners prefer to work with us.
However, U.S. officials do say they are considering ways to improve military capabilities, especially in West Africa. Jeff Selden, VOA News, The Pentagon.
Coming up on 24 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. The World Health Organization is issuing its first ever global guidelines on treating hepatitis C, a liver disease that kills between 350,000 and 500,000 people every year. WHO says the guidelines will reduce deaths from hepatitis C by helping countries improve treatment and care. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The World Health Organization says between 130 and 150 million people globally have chronic hepatitis C infection. The most affected regions are Central and East Asia and North Africa. The hepatitis C virus is mainly spread through exposure to contaminated blood. This can happen through unsafe healthcare practices involving the reuse of needles and syringes. A significant number of people who are chronically infected with hepatitis C will develop liver cirrhosis or liver cancer. WHO is publishing its guidelines as more effective and safer oral hepatitis medicines become more readily available on the market. Stefan Wichter, head of WHO's Global Hepatitis Program, says hepatitis C can be treated and cured, and he says treatments are getting better all the time.
Up until recently, to treat somebody with hepatitis C was required approximately 48 weeks of weekly injections of medicine called interferon, which was very toxic, very difficult to take, and really discouraged people from taking the medicine. Now the newer treatments are much shorter, 12 weeks. Some of them are treated without any injections at all and result in more than 90% cure rates.
Unfortunately, Dr. Wichter says most people in the world do not receive treatment for this illness. This is largely due to the lack of awareness of the problem and the lack of healthcare workers trained to recognize and deal with the disease. However, he notes the biggest problem is that most people do not have any symptoms. Therefore, they do not know they may be at risk and should be tested. He says the infection too often remains undiagnosed until serious liver damage has developed. Another major problem is hepatitis C treatment is unaffordable for most patients. Dr. Wichter says the newer drugs can cost as much as $84,000 for a 12-week course of treatment. He acknowledges price is a huge challenge to overcome.
To bridge that gap between the promise of these new medicines and sort of the reality of low coverage, we are issuing, WHO developed its first ever treatment guidelines. And these guidelines, since they come with the WHO seal of approval and are strongly evidence-based, we feel will be an important tool for decision makers in countries who are considering starting or scaling up hepatitis treatment programs to give them the recommendations that they can use to help guide the development of that program. Similarly, they can help healthcare workers in how to manage patients.
The new guidelines provide recommendations on screening for hepatitis C infection, on medical care to slow the progress of the disease, and on safe and effective treatments to cure chronic hepatitis C infection. They also suggest measures that can be taken to prevent the transmission of the hepatitis C virus. These include instructions on safe medical procedures regarding injections in a healthcare setting and among people who inject drugs. WHO officials say they are sure the price of treatment will come down dramatically as more people use and benefit from the new drugs. They note that treatment for HIV/AIDS used to cost $10,000 when it was first introduced. They say the same and better drugs now cost $100. WHO says competition from generic HIV drug manufacturers, mainly in India, and the huge expansion of the market for these drugs has driven down prices, making it much cheaper for governments to scale up treatment. It says it expects a similar downward spiral in the price of hepatitis C drugs to occur. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Rob McLean, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bungani in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at UpfrontAfrica.